This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. My co-host Craig Blumenschein is on assignment today. Coming up in the second half of today's show, a school, the focal point of many a small town. So what happens when one has to close its doors? And speaking of education, we are going to start today with our third interview featuring a candidate seeking election to be superintendent of public instruction. On Monday, we heard from the current office holder, Kirsten Baszler. Yesterday, we heard from Jim Bartlett. And today, we hear from candidate Jason Heidkamp. And we have reached out to candidate Darko Dragonic. He has not yet responded to our repeated requests for an interview. Here's Craig Blumenschein visiting with Jason Heidkamp.
Jason, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for inviting me to come on today.
Jason, you previously served as a Richland County Commissioner, a city council member in Botineau and Prairie Rose, and you're a member of the Richland County Job Development Authority. How does that translate in you being the superintendent of public instruction?
Well, I'd like to add one more thing. I was a financial advisor, and I also farmed. And so through all of this stuff together, it transfers really well, because the one thing that people don't talk about with this job is the dollars that are involved in, like, the state land trust and the boards that are involved. And so we do get people that are kind of stuck on the curriculum and stuff like that and the proficiency scores, but there's so much more to the job that people don't really talk about.
And we're going to get into a unique way that you want schools to be funded here in just a little bit. But I want to begin our discussion with a question about equity of education in the state. Can you tell me today that a child maybe in West Fargo has access to the same resources and schooling as someone in very rural North Dakota?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I graduated in 1983. We had a thing called MNDAC, which they've changed it now to Southeast Tech. But we were able, in our junior and senior year, to get on a bus and go to Wopton. And we could take classes in distributive education. We could take classes in auto mech, building trades, nursing. And so I do believe that in this day and age, especially with the technology, that the kids should be able to get a lot accomplished if they know what they want to do. My daughter was actually able to take college credits in high school in Wymer, North Dakota, which helped her to double major in less than 4 years when she got the NDSU.
What about facilities across the state? Is it your perception that they're equal, or that some districts really have a challenge with their physical facilities, their physical infrastructure?
Well, I think every facility is unique. And I don't, you know, in Louisiana, for example, New Orleans, there's buildings that are 300 years old and are made out of wood. I was on the Richland County Historical Society as the president. And my job was, I tried to save two different buildings in Wahpeton because they were 100 years old and they needed to be torn down. Nobody knew why, but they just needed to be torn down. I wasn't able to be successful with the one building, which was a shame because we had National Guard members from the Spanish-American War and the Philippine conflict that were able to get 10 Medals of Valor out of that place. And that place should have been saved. But we did get to save the old fire hall, and it's a great place to go to.
In your eyes, what's the biggest challenge ahead for K-12 education here in North Dakota?
Well, we're right now on a worldly basis. I'll say worldly because I'm only used to national, but on a worldly basis, we rank 16th in math, 34th in science, and 9th in reading. They're using a lot of technology, and I'm almost to the point where I believe that, and a lot of studies are coming through right now saying that the technology should not be given to the kids for an extended period of time when they're under a certain age. They shouldn't have it for all day. They should have it for parts of the day and not for all day. And we need, I call it survival skills. The other morning I got up, it was 2:30 in the morning, and I had to get to Bismarck. I had a whole slate of interviews to do, and there was no power at the farm, none. So you need to be able to dress and get ready and take off in the dark with no power. We've been out of power for over a week at a time at the farm when it was, you know, not below zero, but darn cold. And we need to be able to survive and things like that. So I think everybody wants to give technology to everybody. I think our goal is to learn how technology and other sources can be used.
You've talked about property tax reductions.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, eliminating property taxes to support education.
Yes.
Why is that a good idea?
Well, I think that we should follow the Constitution. I have 10 ideas that I started with when I came into this race. And the first thing was not only teaching the North Dakota and the United States Constitution, but actually following it. And the North Dakota Constitution says that the state shall provide education and that the state shall provide secondary education, which would be defined nowadays as post-secondary education with the ability of tuition. And so it also states that we cannot use property taxes to pay the expenses, you know, that the state has. So they've been given a mill levy, which I believe is unconstitutional, and it's 45% to 55% of your property tax bill, whether you rent or own. And in some places of the state, it's getting up to 60%. And so Kirsten Basler, our present superintendent, said when she started 12 years ago that the state was paying 60% of the education. Now, today, we're up to about 80%. So we're not that far away from paying 100%. And that is what the Constitution calls for. I've also talked to people quite a bit about the fact that when you do go to post-secondary education, there are buildings and maintenance provided. There's food. There's housing. You pay it with tuition, obviously. But K through 12 is a priority, and I believe that the state should own the buildings and that, you know, our superintendent should try to educate the kids instead of working on bond issues or roof leaks.
So you're saying the state should also build and maintain buildings as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we pay a lot of costs for architectural fees, pay a lot of money for bonding, pay a lot of money for maintaining the schools, things like that. I believe that we could do it faster, easier, better if that was all in at the DPI.
Where does the funding come from if we aren't assessing property taxes for people for education? Where's the difference?
Well, we do have $7 billion that's in the state land trust that was given to us at statehood by the federal government. We do have the legacy fund, which has $10 billion in it. There are a lot of funds out there, like the SIF fund and everything like that, that the state has. And they kind of tell you what you're getting for a return on the investment, but yet we don't really get to use the money. And so a lot of the smaller schools, like I have a school that was in District 26 when I was a senator, Oaks, North Dakota, they wanted to pass a bond to fix their school up, and the people cannot afford the property taxes. So what I would like to see is I'd like to see using the land trust. I'd like to see using part of the legacy fund earnings. I would actually like to see a statewide sales tax because that would be a regressive tax, whereas the property tax right now is an inflationary tax and continues to go up. And it's not only hurting people who are retired, it's starting to hurt people who are in the middle age part, say from 35 to 50 years old. It's hurting them.
Does the state spend enough on education today?
The state, you will find on the DPI's website that the cost per pupil is anywhere from $14,000 to $22,000 per student. Now, the strange part about that is, and I'm just going to bring up something here, the superintendent's, one of the things the superintendent of public instruction is supposed to do is implement a uniform system of accounting, budgeting, and reporting school district data. Now, like I said, you'll see a difference of $14,000 and $22,000 at two different parts on the DPI website. That's not a transparent figure. They should be the same, okay? And I'm sorry I went off on a tangent there, but a lot of people feel it's either $11,000 or $15,000 or something like that. We actually have some schools that are $81,000 per pupil cost. Now, that doesn't include the building, transportation like buses, activities. I feel that we're supposed to provide education to the students. I think that we need to set up budgets, we need to look at them, and we need to provide the education.
Relative to teachers, are they adequately paid in the state of North Dakota?
Well, you know, it depends on who you talk to.
How about you? What do you think?
I think that we're going to have to assess it once I have the ability to assess it, okay? We find out, and I do have the numbers here, believe it or not. Nationwide, the average is $81,000. Now, in North Dakota, there's two different figures. One is $56,000 and one is $67,000. They haven't quite figured out which one it is. But the living wage in North Dakota is $61,000 per person, all right? So we need to look at it, and we need to figure it out. I know that there was an interview recently where they said, you know, the priority of the superintendent of public instruction was to make sure our teachers were paid, you know, properly and stuff. But I don't know if you know this or not, but in the last year, the percentage increase in teacher pay was 0.76%. Now, that's not 76%. That's 0.76%.
Less than a percent.
Yep. And so, you know, right there shows that we are not paying them properly, and we need to make sure that they are being paid properly. And that's one of my priorities.
We talked about teacher shortages off mic, and you asked them maybe different thoughts about, do we have a teacher shortage here in North Dakota? Expand on your thoughts.
I graduated in 1983. We had 36 kids. At that point, we had one teacher for 18 kids. Now, Truth in ND Education, which is a Facebook page, you can go out and you can look at every school district, 168 school districts, and you can see what the per pupil for teacher is. A lot of them around the 12, you know, one teacher per 12.
You're talking about student-teacher ratios.
Correct. So a lot of them are, say, one teacher to 12 students. I know that Williston had some coming in at one teacher for 17 students. I'm not saying that in the future there isn't going to be a shortage of teachers, but at the present time, I need to look into it to see, because a lot of these classes now, they have paras, they have teachers. There's so many more people involved with classes than there was back in 1983. So I have to find out what their definition of a teacher shortage is. Is it paras? Is it teachers? Is it people in the system that are coming up? And that's how I would answer the question.
Do you believe that the state is attracting young teachers at the rate that it needs to? In other words, is this still an attractive vocation for a young person to consider here in North Dakota?
When I worked in oil fields up in West Hope, and it said 40 below on the thermometer in your vehicle, it was 40 below. And so you go from extremes in temperatures to things like this. We need to do things to attract teachers. There's no doubt about it. We need to keep the area safe. We have crime that's starting to expound in North Dakota. We need to make sure that the crime is down. We need to make sure that there's things for people to do. And we need to pay them and make sure they're educated. And so, you know, when you're saying how to attract the teachers, that's what we have to do. Because when it could be 105 degrees in the summer or 40 below in the wintertime, it takes a special person to want to live in North Dakota. And so we got to make sure that they want to live here.
Relative to private schools, it seems there are more and more as we move forward.
Well, the school board still sets the curriculum and does the hiring and firing. And so if that's how they want to feel, that's how they want to feel. But I said, so they still have the power to do that. We are seeing that a lot of the lower cost per pupil and the better education comes from the parochial schools. We see a lot of students migrating to either homeschooling or parochial schools. I think that is one thing that the superintendent is really going to have to work on is how do we retain students in the public schools, because the last 12 years has not been easy on the kids in the schools, and we're losing kids to homeschooling and to parochial schools. So that's going to be a big subject.
Is that a concerning trend that you see?
Well, I want to see kids get education, so it's not concerning on that end.
What's your responsibility as state superintendent to a privately educated student?
Well, we have to make sure that, for one thing, that they're being educated, okay? One thing I got in trouble for early on in the race, I just answered a question with the truth, okay? I was at the homeschool convention, and I stated out loud that, you know, if you're going to accept money from the state, that it's going to come with strings. I mean, I wanted them to know that. And one of the strings I was talking about was, you know, if you say you're educating six kids and you're getting paid per student, we're going to have to come out and make sure that there's six kids there. I mean, I don't want to come look at your bathroom or your fridge or your oven or anything like that, but there have to be strings involved to make sure that the kids are getting the education.
I want to talk to you about school safety and mental health issues relative that students are facing today, perhaps that they didn't 20 years ago or so. Specifically, simple question, how should North Dakota middle schools and high schools deal with students' cell phones?
I think that, and the studies are coming out that says that smartphones should not be given to kids under a certain age. It's not good for them. And so I know a lot of a lot of parents want to make sure that their kids have a cell phone in case there is a problem or something like that. Now, we never had that growing up, just so you know. I mean, I never had my first cell phone until probably 9 years after I got out of high school, all right? And so I understand where they're coming from. I think that we're going to have to find a way to just give them, you know, like burner phones or something like that, and not the smartphones until they reach a certain age.
Enjoying our conversation with Jason Heitkamp. He's a candidate for the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction. How about mental health, I guess, infrastructure within our schools? Are we able to meet students' needs today, since perhaps they are different from how they were when you and I went to school?
Well, years ago, if you got in trouble, they told your parents, and your parents believed you or believed the school that you were in trouble, and then they took care of it, okay? Nowadays, we actually have schools that tell the parents that the kids were in trouble, and some of the parents don't want to believe that Johnny or Susie caused trouble, okay? We have to find a way, because right now, teachers need to educate and not instill values that should be found at home. We're finding a lot of agendas out there where teachers are supposed to co-parent with the parents. We can't do that. We can't do that. The training for discipline has to start at home. We can't start it when they get into school, because by then they're already, you know, 5, 6 years old. What happened previous to that? I never had a daycare when I was growing up. My mom died when I was 2 and a half. I had to spend every day with my dad on the farm. There was no daycare. There was no babysitter. There was nothing. It was me and him, and we farmed. And I learned to respect him, and he learned to respect me, and that's what we need to do as a family again.
Jason, I want to ask you about libraries and schools. There's been a lot of talk about libraries and books in schools, and what's your vision of the role of school libraries in promoting literacy and learning?
Well, I can tell you what. My dad never came to a library with me when I was a kid, just so you know. The only library I knew was in our school. Until years later, I actually found out about the Fargo Library. It had to do with Wi-Fi. So a lot of times I would go spend time when I was in town here doing financial planning at the library, so I had Wi-Fi, okay? There's a lot of uses for the library. In the last session of the Senate and the House in North Dakota, they had the library bill. It kind of got convoluted because a lot of people felt that they wanted to ban books or burn books, all right? I don't believe that any book has been burned since that law was passed or that any book was banned. They were put into sections where if the parents wanted to come in with the child and they wanted a certain book, that they could take it out, but it was not to be given out to kids that were younger than a certain age, all right? The reason I bring this up and the reason I explained it so well is we actually have a candidate for Superintendent of Public Instruction who in the last 10 days has said on 2 different interviews that he's going to take curriculum and he's going to make a big bonfire with it and burn it. That is something that I will never do, okay? That's something I don't think our present Superintendent of Public Instruction would do. It's scary to hear something like that.
Jason, we have about a minute left.
Yep.
Why are you the best qualified candidate for the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction?
Well, if you look at the whole definition for the Superintendent of Public Instruction, you're going to see a lot of things in there. You're going to see boards. You're going to see dollars that are invested. You're going to see where you have to appoint somebody to a board. You have to know this, that, and the other thing. A lot of people like to get bogged down in the curriculum, but there are many people that work at DPI already that know about curriculum, all right? And so I want to be the one that actually works on the things that people don't talk about. Going back to the Constitution, you know, I talked about increasing graduation rates, decreasing administrative costs, renegotiating interstate education programs. I mean, a lot of people don't even know that we work with the state of Minnesota and North Dakota on programs like that. And the last thing is healthy lifestyles. We've really started to see a lot of people coming out talking about the processed foods and stuff like that. And I want to make sure that there is a curriculum so that kids can learn at a young age about the benefits of processed foods and the detriments of processed foods so that they can live a healthy lifestyle.
Jason Heidkamp, he's one of four nonpartisan candidates for the office of State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Jason, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513. And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Maybe you've heard this phrase before. Leaves of three, let it be. Something that you can at least partly rely on to identify poison ivy and poison oak. We get more tips on that and how to keep your dog safe from skunks from biologist Chuck Lura in this week's Natural North Dakota.
Summer's upon us. And it seems like every summer, questions come up on how to identify poison ivy and what to do if a dog has been sprayed by a skunk. A little reminder of identification of poison ivy and treatment of skunk spray might be helpful. Poison ivy has been documented in all but a handful of counties in North Dakota. Although the form of poison ivy may vary, in North Dakota it's a sparsely branched upright shrub that grows to 1 or 2 feet tall, and because it's rhizomatous, it often grows in patches. The casual observer may not notice that it's a shrub, but a closer look will reveal the woody growth. The old saying, leaves in three, let it be, is good advice. The leaves, alternately arranged on the stem, grow near the tip of a branch. These shiny leaflets, about as long as wide, are produced from distinctive leaf stalks. The leaf margins may be entire or perhaps coarsely toothed. The leaves may be 2 inches long early in the growing season, but become larger as the season progresses. And the leaves often droop and may have a distinctively reddish or bronzy tinge. The flowers, produced in June, are rather inconspicuous, but the fruits are pale yellow with perhaps a tint of green, about 1/4 inch in diameter, and often quite noticeable. Simply touching the leaves may result in blistering. The active agent is an oil. So flushing the exposed area with water doesn't work. Technu, that's a trademark name, is a product that's effective on skin, clothing, and other items contaminated with poison ivy oils. The results of a dog getting into a skirmish with a skunk is self-evident. But then what? Treatment with tomato juice is often suggested, but that doesn't work. There may be some over-the-counter treatments that work, but a chemist has developed an effective treatment using household ingredients. It involves liberally bathing the dog in a mixture of hydrogen peroxide, baking soda, and liquid soap or dish detergent. I put photographs and links to more information on poison ivy, along with links to the treatment for skunk spray, along the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Still to come on Main Street, Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon. That's coming up right after this.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Deputy Director of Administration for the North Dakota Department of Transportation says artificial intelligence could be beneficial for DOT operations. Mike Earhart told the Interim Information Technology Committee DOT is partnering with UND in research projects on using AI. For example,
NDDOT is currently testing adaptive signal controllers on 12th Avenue in Fargo. These controllers utilize AI to adjust the timing of traffic signals with the goal of mitigating traffic congestion and enhancing traffic safety.
Gerhardt says AI may be used to inspect structures on the state highways, as well as determining driving conditions such as icy roads, and he says it could be used in analyzing crash data.
Currently we have team members that analyze crash data. We believe that AI could do it more effectively and may find things that we might miss or might look for different, like enhance our ability to analyze crash data to support our current crash reduction efforts as an agency.
And Gerhardt says another possibility would be to have AI help with some of the phone calls the agency receives. He says DOT receives about 150,000 calls per year.
It's possible to leverage AI to assist with providing a response to many of those inquiries. Now, it wouldn't necessarily respond to all inquiries. Some of the inquiries we receive are complex and they take time and research, but it would allow us to manage that call volume so we could spend more time and respond to those ones that are more detailed in a timely manner.
Gerhardt says there is more research to be done. The interim committee is tasked with a study of artificial intelligence. And from Memorial Day to Labor Day, summer is in full swing. North Dakotans can finally enjoy some much-needed time in the sun. But to transportation officials, this time period has a much more serious significance. They call it the 100 deadliest days of the year.
We actually see a decrease in crashes overall because it's not winter time, but the severity of the crashes is significantly worse during those 100 days. Just in the last 24 hours, we've had 3 fatalities on North Dakota's roadways. So I thought it was kind of timely just because exactly what we see in these 100 deadliest days is just happened in the last 24 hours here.
That was Jenna Clausen-Hubrights, a sergeant with the North Dakota Highway Patrol. She says the reason crashes are deadlier, even though there are fewer, is because people are a lot less careful on the road in the summer.
And they're more deadly usually because of the speed. People tend to slow down in the wintertime because they're paying more attention to the roadway. And so we see speed as a significant factor. That drinking and driving picks up a lot in the summertime. And then because people are a lot more relaxed, they're not paying attention to the roadway. And so, again, less crashes in the summertime, but they are significantly more deadly.
North Dakota has had 25 roadway fatalities so far this year. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
All right, hope you're hungry. It is time now to talk with Rick Guillon for Prairie Plates. Has your stomach recovered from the burgers you ate at the recent Burger Royale?
They kicked off the downtown Fargo Burger Royale Friday morning early, and I started with the burger about 8 a.m. over at Beer and Fish Company.
That's not a good time to eat a burger.
I couldn't help it. Kick off the day the right way.
And now it's food truck season. Let's talk a little bit about what are some of the big food truck festivals around the state.
Well, you'll see this summer events organized by 701 Food Trucks, and there are others too. Yeah, a lot of food truck festivals around the state, usually July, August, September. Grand Forks, Fargo, Bismarck, Minot, Watford City, Dickinson, all over the state. And all sorts of food trucks from all over the state come to these festivals, and it's quite popular. There are different judging competitions like Make and Bacon, Best of the Fest. There's a Bloody Mary competition at a lot of these too. And it's just a lot of fun.
Have you ever cooked in a food truck?
Yeah, there isn't a lot of room in a food truck. You can't fit a lot of people in a food truck either. And yes, it gets really hot. Most of them are really retrofitted to, if it's a truck or a trailer, they're retrofitted to be able to cook, grill a lot of things, bake. Sometimes some of that stuff is pre-made in other commercial kitchens that are licensed and that sort of thing.
Oh, and kind of just reheated on the spot?
Yeah, some of it's reheated, but some of it is added to and that sort of thing. But there are mobile food vendors, too, that have a tent, and then they'll set up, like, hotel pans with heaters underneath, that sort of thing.
Sure.
And so there are different rules and regulations for these things, too. Different places in the state require different things. And so I've talked to a lot of food truck owners, and that can get really complicated really fast. And a lot of them get really agitated talking about that. So,
well, yeah. Do you have any idea? And this is maybe a little too far outside your field of expertise, but, you know, I can see needing to get licensed if you're crossing state lines. But if you're staying within the state, what is with the need for different regulations?
Yeah, there are local licenses, state licenses, I think county licenses. I don't know if you need to have all those things. Health inspectors will come out. Owning a food truck, you cut down on the cost of owning a big restaurant, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are a lot of other things to think about. These folks work tremendously hard.
Yeah.
These food trucks are hot inside. Often they have fryers, griddles, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You're sweating bullets. It is not an easy gig.
Well, and I'm just thinking the few times that I have fried in my house, I get a headache almost immediately. I'm fine if I can fry something outdoors. I'm just wondering, are there health concerns for people who are working in these food trucks?
I don't know. And in the instance of K-Dog Korean corn dogs, they get so busy at the Red River Market, the line gets to be like 100 people long sometimes, and I'm not exaggerating, and they fry these corn dogs all day, you know, early in the morning, into the afternoon, and it just has to be miserable. But they are delicious, so don't stop making them.
And remember, consumers, this is why we tip.
Yes, tip well.
Okay, well, what are some of the food trucks that are, you know, the tastiest or the most unique kinds of experiences that you want to introduce us to?
Yeah, so I've judged at the Fargo Food Truck Festival for 10 years in a row. This should be the 11th year, and then Grand Forks Food Truck Festival 2 years. And so a lot of food trucks from Western North Dakota and different parts of the state, Western Minnesota, will go to these food trucks. So it's these food truck festivals. So it's a lot to sample.
Yeah. Do you get to wear a sash? As a judge.
No.
Not enough sashes in the world.
I'd wear maybe a special hat or something. I don't know. But sash. But yeah, I've tried a lot of food truck vendors, and I tell you, some of them don't go to these food truck festivals. You'll just find them randomly or at a market or something like that. But I really enjoy Namaste Kitchen, which is the same owner as Namaste Chai. And Namaste Chai is a favorite around this office, that's for sure. Saigon Cuisine is a Vietnamese mobile food vendor. They're not a truck. They're more of a tent. Taco Revolution, that's a trailer. K-Dog, Korean corn dogs, I mentioned before. That's more of a trailer. Beefcakes ND.
I mean, that just sounds like it could be a calendar.
Well, the owner is quite a character. I'm sure he'd pose for you. I don't know.
But what is that? Is it a cakes of beef here? Like, why is it called beefcakes?
He is a quirky guy, and he just sets up like 2 or 3 times a year. And yeah, you got to look on Instagram. I don't think he even has a Facebook account, but he sets up 2 or 3 times a year in the summertime in the Fargo area. And it's Oklahoma style smash burgers.
What is an Oklahoma style smash burger?
And for short, sometimes they say Okie style smash burger. I don't know. But they're like thinly shaved onions.
Ooh, I'm listening.
And you take the burger patty and smash it down with a big spatula with the onions included in it. And usually you get 2 or 3 patties. And this is the one I had on Beer and Fish on Friday morning. And that one had 2 big patties, but that was an Oklahoma-style smash burger.
And that was your breakfast. I can't get over that was your breakfast.
And that burger was actually called the Ricky Bobby. But back to Beefcakes ND, yeah, he just kind of goes around and sets up. He'll send out like a bat signal on Instagram, and he'll sell out within an hour. And he actually has a Ford van, and the license plate says Beef Wagon on it. So it's really kind of a fun thing. Some more food trucks from out of the Fargo area. I really enjoy The Wok from Grand Forks, which is Filipino cuisine. That one is, it's very popular. It's won a lot of awards. Mabel's All Day in Bismarck, the chef owner there, he really knows what he's doing on a lot of fronts with fried chicken sandwiches, with burgers, with tacos, desserts. He's a really, really good cook. And then Fish Factor 108, if you're ever in the Lakes area, Fergus Falls, Otter Tail County, Minnesota, I really enjoy Fish Factor 108. It's kind of an Asian fish spin, and it's just really, really good. And one I really miss in Fargo here was at Fargo Brewing for quite a long time, called Luchador, and it was very good Mexican style street food. It was just really
named
good.
After the wrestlers, the Mexican wrestlers.
Yeah, and they had like wrestler graphics on the outside of it. It was just really, really fun. It was a fun truck. Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of fabulous. Well, you know, you are not mentioning any desserts.
Yes. There are desserts. Well, you can always find the mini donut truck somewhere.
Well, yeah. Come on.
And they are delicious. He's usually at these food truck festivals quite a bit. There's always stuff on a stick, fried Oreos, yeah, that sort of thing, that fried Snickers, that can get interesting.
I mean, is it considered a food truck if it's just like hard scoop ice cream from a truck, or does it have to be something you're cooking or at least reheating and repackaging in the food truck for it to count as food truck? That, is this philosophical or legal definition?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not the food truck police, so I'm not really sure, but I do. I just enjoy the food and don't really think about those sorts of things, I guess.
Okay. Well, it sounds like entrepreneurs out there, you know, that maybe there's some room in the market for a little bit more dessert.
I think you're on to something. You know, we come up with some good ideas on this show.
We really got to start acting on them, Rick. All right. Well, if any of our listeners also have some great ideas or would feel free to correct us on anything, send an email to plates@prairiepublic.org. And Rick, a reminder how to find you and your group on Facebook.
Well, my group is called Fargo Moorhead Eats, Fargo-Moorhead Eats. It's a group on Facebook. We're getting up to about 38,000 members, so be our 38,001 member.
One member, and come hungry.
Yes.
Thanks, Rick.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at starianbank.com.
This is Main Streets on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. When seniors walk across the stage at graduation, they walk into the next phase of their lives, and school goes on without them. Usually, anyway. Recently, in Edmore, North Dakota, the school graduated its final graduating class, and it remains to be seen what will happen to the building and the many memories it holds. Here's Danielle Webster.
The class of 2024 will remember the spring they graduated for years to come. Temperatures were chilly, lots of rain soaked the soil, and in some areas, even a few inches of snow fell. But under the cloud cover, one small school in one small town sent off its final graduating class of seniors. Edmore, North Dakota is located in the northeastern corner of Ramsey County. As of the 2020 census, 139 people live there, and this year the town graduated its senior class from Edmore School, a class of just two students.
So we'll start over there, and we'll all walk in to pomp and circumstance, get up there. I only have two graduates, Alexis and Race. Alexis will get up and do a welcome. Pastor will do the invocation, and then she'll sit down, and Race will get up and do a speech on friends, family, community, and school, four speeches. And then a song will start, This Is Not Goodbye, and they'll pick up their long-stemmed roses, and they'll come down and hand their roses to their parents and give the hugs, and then they'll sit down, and then we'll drop the big screen, and the video will start that I've built that is pictures of them from childhood all through adulthood, and then all their school pictures throughout the years.
Principal Diane Martinson says in all, 17 students attended the K-12 school this year. For several years, the town and school district has done whatever it took to keep the school staffed and the students served. But this year, the writing was on the wall. It was time. Martinson herself had stepped up to serve in any way she could to keep it going as long as it did.
And it's over. 2008, I started as business manager. And then our librarian and our teachers were starting to leave, and I saw it happening. And so I decided to go back to school and get my education degree. And then I got my librarian certificate, so we'd have a librarian because that's mandated by the state. And then our principal was going to leave. And I just, you know, as you knew, the school and town were getting smaller. Nobody wanted to move here. They wanted the bigger cities, the bigger opportunities. So I went back and got my administrative credentials in 2015, and I've been principal ever since.
The city of Edmore was founded in 1901, with its school opening in 1920. The census that year put the city at just over 500 residents, the most people to ever reside there. The city hovered around 400 residents through the 70s and 80s when the United States Army's Safeguard Anti-Ballistic Missile Program established the Stanley R. Mickelson Safeguard Complex close to nearby Nakoma. The complex provided launch and control for 30 anti-ballistic missiles and 70 shorter-range sprint missiles. And while all this was going on, Tammy Berg was getting ready to graduate.
Back then, it was the missile up at Nakoma. So these kids would come and go with their parents, you know, as the missile thing evolved. And, you know, so we had a lot of kids. The lockers here, we shared three deep. There were three kids and girls, you know, that would share those lockers.
Oh, really?
There's a couple shelves, and then there's the bottom. And your winter coat went there, and your girl stuff, and then your books and all that. So we were tight back in those days.
By the time Doug Frege graduated in 1982, the missile program was over. The complex was deactivated in April of 1976, after only 6 months of full operational capacity. As the military families left the area, there were still plenty of local kids around to keep things competitive.
When I was a freshman, we didn't have enough kids for football, so that's when football went away. But we had basketball and baseball, track. When I was in high school, my sophomore, junior, and senior year, we were at state basketball tournament all 3 years. We never did win it. We got second two times my junior and senior year. Baseball. We had a good baseball team. 79, we won the state Babe Ruth. 80 and 81, we won the state high school championship. And then my senior year, 1982, we won the state Legion championship. So we had a good little run there with sports.
Frege has been on the school board for the past 19 years, and for the last 9 of those, he's been president. As population in Edmore and surrounding communities began to thin, the schools would combine forces to give students opportunities to play on sports teams. But eventually, schools in these small cities, like Adams or Hamden, either couldn't keep up with staffing demands or get enough kids to attend. Tough decisions had to be made.
You can't find teachers. And honestly, if somebody graduates out of, say, NDSU or even UND, who wants to come to Edmore, a town of 60, 70 people, and teach here? I mean, it's a good way to start your career, and you get paid well, but there's nothing to do here, so it's hard to get people to come here to teach. You know, on the building we have, the school, we provide housing and meals for teachers and everything, and it's pretty good gig for them, but nobody wants to come here.
Frege says the Edmore School District was able to secure 5 full-time teachers to educate their students. All of them are from the Philippines. He says they were eager to come and gain the work experience, which worked out well for them. Those teachers have made arrangements to begin new jobs in surrounding communities. And parents of students that attended classes in Edmore are still determining where to send those kids to school, be it Langdon to the north or Lakota to the south. But that still leaves the community of Edmore with a beloved building no one is ready to let go of just yet. Principal Diane Martinson says the Edmore School serves as a time capsule for its residents and returning alumni.
So this is only a fraction of the trophies. We kept some of the bigger trophies out here. But there's a room down the hall packed with trophies and trophy. And matter of fact, 2 weeks ago, I got a phone call from a lady that is 63 years old, and she said, if the school closes and it doesn't get to become a community center, can I please have my John Philip Sousa Award? And I went, you're 63. Who cares about a trophy?
Oh, boy,
but,
though.
Oh, they, I tell you, small town, they hold on to their trophies.
Oh, man, look at that.
So we kind of giggled, and I have looked everywhere, and I'm like, I cannot find this lady's trophy.
Trophies denoting athletic, academic, and musical triumphs of Edmore students dating all the way back to the 1920s can be found tucked away in cases, picture windows, unused rooms, and even closets throughout the school. As if to prove just how proud and serious students have been throughout the decades here in Edmore. And while these halls will no longer accumulate those accolades, the community has ideas for the building. Plans have been drawn up to propose the city of Edmore use the building as a community center. Residents already come and go as they please to use the weight room. Perhaps funerals, fundraisers, or town events could be held here. It's even been suggested one of the classrooms could house a golf simulator. But all that hinges upon what's decided in Bismarck. Diane's husband, John, who has worn many hats in service to the school over the years, is hopeful local control will be given deference.
As you go up in government, you look at a bigger picture. Well, that's why, if you're looking at a small area, that's why you're supposed to listen to those people, because they know what's best for their area. You might know what's best overall for your area, depending on what level of government you're in, but that's why you listen to the little spots, because when that legislation or that whatever is happening for that spot, those are the people that are affected. What happens here doesn't affect what happens at a state level. It just affects this community.
Who knows what they'll decide? It was legislative intent to do it, to allow us to do it, but we'll have to see if it goes through. And you know, there's so many people in the summertime that come back and come to the school and walk through and look at their pictures on the wall. And we had a grad from, years ago, back in the 70s probably, that just came in, and he had to take me to the gym and tell me how he got to ride his motorcycle in. He was up for king, and he rode in on his motorcycle and picked the queen candidate up and rode out. And I'm like, there's no way you got to ride on the gym floor, you know. But the memories that they tell you, you know, they just love looking at the pictures on the walls and reminiscing. And so I'm hopeful that they...
Before the graduation ceremony, citizens of Edmore held a banquet to recognize the school's last pupils for their academic achievements. 50 years after the missile complex excitement pulsed through the town, Tammy Berg was there to regale those students with some memories of her glory days.
So this past Sunday, they had an awards evening, a supper, and gave awards, and I spoke about 50 years ago, the differences. We had mini skirts. And I did tell them that I was a starter on our basketball team back in the day. And I, in my own mind, thought I was kind of a jock. You know, then one of my teammates from years ago sent me an article about our team, and my name wasn't even in there. And I hadn't scored any points. And actually, this gal was the jock. She was the one that... Her name was all over that article, you know, but simple things like that.
How your memory kind of evolves over time.
Right. And we graduated 35 students compared to the two that graduate today.
It's clear that whatever the next step is for the Edmore School, those who live here remain proud and committed to preserving its memory for whatever generations may come. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Healthcare is a top priority for voters in the upcoming election.
It's important to note that Latinos have essentially had the lowest access to both health insurance and healthcare among any racial and ethnic group in the country over the last 10 years or so.
Our series, We the Voters, continues with a focus on healthcare and the uninsured on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. to 9 central here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 5th. Leading up to the June 11th primary, we're celebrating democracy in action from North Dakota history, large and small. The first North Dakota legislator recognized as Native American was Arthur Raymond. He was elected in 1970 after having a career in journalism. One of his stories had been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Then there was Republican Dawn Marie Charging, the first Native American woman elected to the legislature. She served one term from 2005 to 2008. Ruth Anna Buffalo was the first Democrat Native American woman to win a seat. She didn't set out to be a politician. In fact, she wanted to be a doctor. She didn't do that either, though she pursued a career in public health. She later said, "I found that I could not work with cadavers my whole senior year, so I had a life-changing decision to make." In an interview with the New York Times, she responded to the question about how she was able to win as a Democrat in a largely conservative state. She said, "I would say meeting people where they're at, literally on their doorsteps. Most people were surprised to see a candidate at their doorstep. They were pretty receptive and open to having a conversation with me on what matters most to them." She campaigned against the Republican incumbent, Rudy Boehning. He was the primary sponsor of a bill Buffalo opposed, requiring Native Americans to have identification with a residential street address in order to vote. After knocking on hundreds of doors and speaking out against voter identification laws that would create obstacles for Native Americans to vote, Ruth Buffalo won the election for State House District 27 in 2018. These are just three examples of the many Native Americans who have been state office holders. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Remember, you can listen to any episode of Main Street at prairiepublic.org. Coming up tomorrow on the show, an important question during this an election year, as we take a critical look at the state of American democracy, and we hear from political philosopher Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein for a discussion on, is America's democracy failing? We also have our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson and a movie review from Madeline. That's all coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.